Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here is your host, Sean Graham.
And thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam podcast, everybody. I am Sean Graham, coming at you nearly live. We are in Victoria, British Columbia, part of Congress and the CHA annual meeting as our, I guess, continuing coverage of Congress as we continue to interview people here. It's the last day, actually. Congress just, or the CHA annual meeting just ended, and it's all over for another year. But there's still opportunity to talk about some of the material that was discussed here. And two of my favorite things are Regina. And one of my favorite things to study is race relations in the United States and the civil rights movement. It's actually the first thing that I ever published was on the civil rights movement in the 1950s. So I'm thrilled to have our guest here today from the University of Regina.
Campion College at the University of Regina.
And I should know that. My MA advisor was in Campion College.
That's right. Yes.
Campion College at the University of Regina. Mm-hmm. Don Flood studies the history of Chicago and in this particular case, the Black Panthers. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
I'm thrilled to have you here. So your presentation the other day on Monday, you talked about Fred Hampton and his visit to what was then the Regina campus of the University of Saskatchewan.
Yes.
But before we really get into the part about Saskatchewan and his visit to Regina, who was Fred Hampton and why is he a notable figure?
Fred Hampton was African-American youth in Illinois. He grew up in Maywood, Illinois, which is a working-class suburb of Chicago. So not in the city proper, but very early on in his life, in his teenage years, he came to the attention both of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, as a youth leader. He helped to organize a youth group in his high school at Maywood, and also helped to organize a campaign to integrate the swimming pools, the public swimming pools in Maywood. Chicago, of course, located on Lake Michigan, you'd think, you know, there's these beaches that people can go swimming all the time, but it's a very segregated city, and a lot of African-American communities, both in the suburbs as well as in the city itself, were located so far away from the lake, miles away, that it might as well have been, you know, the Atlantic coast, right? Yeah. So public pools were often closed to African-American youths because of racial segregation. So he helped to organize around this issue of integrating the pools, the public pools in Maywood, which brought him to the attention of civil rights organizers as a youth leader. It also brought him to the attention of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover. He was put very early on in his teenage years on the Key Agitator Index list, which is a precursor to the infamous COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program, which was funded, I think, in 1968 or 1969 it began. It was an official program within the FBI that trained young agents to kind of learn the lingo of radical youth and to be able to infiltrate and thereby disrupt organizing. Right. So,
like the Americans on TV now, that great FX show.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. So that's who Fred Hampton was. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, very early on in his life, he paid attention to, you know, kind of issues of discrimination, of inequality. He was brought up on charges in Maywood for allegedly sticking up an ice cream truck in a very Robin Hood-esque type of situation. He robbed an ice cream truck, allegedly, and handed out the ice cream bars to the children of the neighborhood, the Black children of the neighborhood. Now, it's questionable whether or not it was actually Fred Hampton who did this. As was very typical in the late 1960s, Black suspects, especially to victims of crime who might have been white, oftentimes misidentified Black suspects. You know, they all kind of look alike, right? Or the police would go after, you know, a Black man they found walking down the street in a wrong neighborhood because he, so, you know, supposedly fit a description. And so it seems like Fred Hampton fell into that kind of situation. So,
It seems as though, I mean, Chicago has the reputation, and even to this day, is very a rough and tumble city, politically and culturally and socially, and to be able to survive in that environment, it's almost like you would have to have that mentality.
Oh, yes.
And almost this, you know, maybe radicalism to be able to become a prominent leader in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And that seems emblematic of just the city as a whole, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Chicago does have a long history of, you know, kind of a working class culture, right? Mm-hmm. A very rough culture. Rough in politics, definitely. The political machine of Chicago, political corruption went hand in hand with police corruption in that city. You know, a long history of violent labor activism going back to the late 19th century. And the civil rights movement in Chicago certainly has a longer history than, you know, kind of the mainstream narrative would tell us, or the traditional narrative. It kind of begins in 1966 when Martin Luther King brought the movement north.
Right.
Obviously, that's not true. Things were going on in Chicago long before King came there. But when King came to Chicago, he encountered a culture that was not entirely foreign to him, certainly in terms of, you know, racial discrimination and white violence toward African Americans. But what he didn't expect was the mayor, Mayor Daley, who held such tight control over the city. And King claimed that he's like, you know, I never encountered this kind of intransigence, this kind of resistance, this kind of trouble, even in Selma, even in, you know, Birmingham. So Chicago does have that history, certainly.
Yeah, and which is interesting because, you know, one of the things we think about Chicago, we think about this vibrant culture and African-American culture in particular that comes out of the city. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you're talking about how this city is actually very segregated and there's these divisions, it's interesting to think, not only because it's a northern city, I mean, I know it's a midwestern city, that the segregation comes through as prominently as it does. It's somewhat surprising, I think, and like you say, it goes against that mainstream narrative of the civil rights movement.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons why we think about the traditional narrative of civil rights as, you know, kind of southern segregation, northern racial utopia, well, obviously this is not the case, right? The South in the U.S. to this day has a larger black population. So while racial segregation was the order of the day, whites and blacks, I mean, they were neighbors. They mixed in town in a way that just didn't happen in northern cities. When African Americans began migrating to the north, in Chicago in particular, it began in the 1910s, mostly as a way to take advantage of job opportunities during the Great War, during World War I. And they moved to distinct neighborhoods. And these neighborhoods were very small neighborhoods and couldn't absorb as quickly as they needed to the population influx. This happened in World War I, but especially in World War II. Because in World War II, more African Americans were coming north, more job opportunities. The U.S. was in World War II longer than they participated in World War I. And also, and this is huge, mechanized cotton picking, the mechanized cotton picker. It eliminated the career of sharecropping. As bad of a career as that was, one could eke out a living if they didn't own their own land as a sharecropper picking cotton. Once the mechanized cotton picker came into place, that displaced black workers, and they had to go somewhere. And so you see in northern cities, Chicago, Detroit, New York, you see race riots happening during World War II as these traditional, historically black neighborhoods begin pushing against the boundaries of ethnic white working class neighborhoods. And so you get a maintenance of racial segregation in the North in ways that you just didn't have in the South.
But then it's interesting, too, because Emmett Till was from Chicago.
He was.
And he goes down to the South and the lynching of Emmett Till. If you don't know the story, Google it. There's a documentary, a beautiful documentary that was done about it. That was my first exposure to the story. But he's lynched for whistling. Yeah. Allegedly whistling at a white woman, and then he gets lynched in a very horrifying way.
Yes.
But then I'm wondering then, because a big part of the story is his mother's reaction, that she publishes the photos of the it's really actually quite violent.
Yes.
The photos, the way he was, the violence that was done on to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, is her activism in that respect, of having those pictures published, part of this wider cultural situation in Chicago that it was response to the segregation that she would be experiencing on a daily basis as much as it is a reaction to her son's death?
I mean, I think that's an interesting point. Emmett Till, of course, you know, came to the South with somewhat different racial attitudes, right? This picture of a white girl he had in his wallet that he liked to brag to his Southern cousins that this was his girlfriend. probably the picture came with the wallet, you know. Chicago black teenagers did not date white teenagers, right, in the 1950s. And probably he didn't encounter white people very often, right? Mm-hmm. Because these black neighborhoods in Chicago were self-sustaining neighborhoods, right? You lived there, you went to school there, you know, their parents usually worked in these neighborhoods. So he wouldn't have encountered white people all that often. You know, if he went downtown, maybe riding on a streetcar, yeah, he could sit in the front of the L car, the elevated train, the subway. He didn't have to ride in the back of the bus, but he didn't encounter white people very often. So he came south with different racial attitudes. And I think his mother perhaps didn't necessarily impart the lessons of racial segregation that she would have grown up being aware of.
Right.
And so she didn't tell him not to do that, right? He didn't expect that to be such a strict rule, because he could maybe sit next to a white teenager on the subway even if he wasn't going to date her.
Right.
This was an absolute separate rule in the South, right? And Emmett Till didn't know it. And so I think her response was, I want the world to see what they did to my boy, as a way of waking up the North, right, to the horrors of Southern segregation, definitely.
And then so one of the groups that's really active in the North, and it's interesting because when we think of the civil rights movement in the 50s and the 60s, a lot of it comes to the NAACP, CORE, SNCC, these groups. And they're so much associated with the South, even though the SCLC.
The SCLC was it began in the South.
It's a Southern group.
Southern,
But Christian. The rest of them are national organizations. Yeah. But the way in which they're framed is that they're groups operating in the South and they need the assistance of Northerners.
Yeah.
And as opposed to being national organizations that are pushing for racial equality across the country. But I think one of those groups that I think is characterized as a national group is the Black Panther Party. And so I'm wondering then, how is the Black Panther Party operating in Chicago, and how are they doing it differently from some of these other organizations?
That's a great question. The Black Panthers were originally founded in Oakland, California in 1966, co-founded by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. These are the, you know, the big names, the lore of the party. And it began from the start very much as an urban group, right? They took the image of the Black Panther. Possibly they took this image from Alabama, from Lowndes County, Alabama, from a more, you know, kind of radicalized militant group associated with the Southern Civil Rights Movement. But from the start, the Black Panthers were organized in cities. They were organized around issues of urban poverty, of police violence in the cities. You know, Southern sheriffs were certainly violent against civil rights marchers, but that was at the march, right? Those were at the marches. It wasn't an everyday thing the way, you know, black residents in urban ghettos in the North were getting, you know, targeted by the police all the time and getting beat up by the police for no reason whatsoever except for just walking down the street, you know, if the police felt like it. And so this was one of the issues that the Black Panthers immediately began organizing around, this idea of policing the police. We're going to watch the police. We're going to make sure that they don't harass innocent African-Americans for no reason, right? We're going to use the laws to our advantage. This idea, California at the time had open carry laws. You could carry guns, right? Black people didn't carry guns. So when the Black Panthers first marched on the Capitol in Sacramento armed, all of a sudden the FBI was like, we got a different kind of group on our hands here. You know, this was a much scarier image to especially white liberals who might have felt very good about themselves and supporting the idea of racial equality and sending money to help support King's organization and break up the, you know, coloreds only, whites only drinking fountains and washrooms in the South. You know, they could feel good about themselves in resisting that. But all of a sudden they're coming face to face with, you know, large Negroes with guns. And that changed a lot of white minds at the time. They became very scared. And very quickly, the FBI targeted the group as one of the most dangerous, as a threat to national security. And to be fair, one of the main kind of raison d'etre, if you will, of the Black Panther Party was the overthrow, the revolution of society, the overthrow of capitalism, of imperialism, of fascism, right? Well, it's all well and good to overthrow fascism, but in Cold War America, to say you want to overthrow capitalism, that was a pretty threatening gesture.
And yet the organization has this reputation as like you say, it's something that is seen as dangerous. Mm-hmm. But in terms of their community organizing, mm-hmm. they're very proactive in simply mobilizing programs to help the community.
Yeah.
So how is there, or how can we understand the organization mm-hmm. and balance this, you know, carrying guns to the Capitol versus mm-hmm. a breakfast program?
Right, exactly.
How do we reconcile that? Mm-hmm. Because they seem such divergent mm-hmm. activities.
Yeah. Well, I think that the guns part, right, the Black Panther Party, its original name was the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, right? Yeah. So the idea of using violence and self-defense to defend the rights, the inherent rights of racial minorities, right? Mm. That's what people were forgetting about, that African Americans shouldn't have to struggle for rights. They had these rights as U.S. citizens, right? So that's the guns part. And that's the part that appealed to who the Panthers were targeting. They wanted to recruit members, tough members who didn't kowtow to the man, right? They went after gang members. They said, you know, you've been able to survive in the streets. We want to focus your anger at the police. We want to channel that energy into productive means of revolutionizing society. They didn't want a part of the pie. They wanted to throw the pie out, right? And so the guns part is what appealed to the membership, right? That made them look cool.
Yeah.
And it gave emasculated Black men a sense of empowerment, right? You know, no longer were ghetto police going to kick in their heads. They were going to fight back. But it was the socialist-oriented reform programs, the providing free breakfast for school children, providing free medical clinics in the ghetto, political education programs, liberation schools, teaching Black culture, Black history to Panther children. There's wonderful images of, you know, little Panther kids going to school in what would today just be school uniforms, but they're like mini versions of the Panthers with the berets and the black leather and such. They didn't have guns because they were kids. But
that's good.
Exactly. So, you know, on the one hand, self-defense is part of the party. But on the other hand, it was this idea of revolutionizing society. We're going to overthrow capitalism, because the Panther leaders understood, Huey P. Newton understood this from the start, and many leaders, including Fred Hampton, understood from the start that poverty caused all manner of problems, that it wasn't racial segregation per se that was causing poverty, although certainly they went hand in hand, but poverty caused, you know, a desperation that led street youth into perhaps the abuse of drugs and you know, crime to feed that abuse of drugs, right? So if we can overthrow capitalism, if we can give racial minorities, all progressive peoples, a fair shot, then we won't have to worry about this kind of violence on the streets anymore.
Given that this is sort of this is their mandate, this is what they're trying to accomplish, why in the world would they come to Regina, Saskatchewan to give a talk at the Regina campus of the University of Saskatchewan?
Yes, it was a surprising event. When I first learned about it, I said this in my talk, I first learned about it when I arrived in Regina at Campion College in 2005 now, it's 8 years ago. The second semester I was teaching a modern U.S. history course, got to the 60s, started talking about the civil rights movement, mentioned Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party in Chicago, because I was very familiar with Chicago. And the students told me, my students told me that he came to this campus, right, in 1969. And I thought, well, how could that be? He was killed he was murdered by Chicago police in December of 1969. And the Chicago chapter of the Black Panthers wasn't organized until 1968, so it's a very small window of a tour. And so I you know, started looking into this a little bit. And what I discovered was that, in fact, Fred Hampton and two of his colleagues from the Chicago chapter, or at the time it was called the Illinois chapter, it was the only chapter of the Black Panther Party in the state of Illinois. So I call it the Chicago chapter, but its official title was the Illinois chapter. Two of his colleagues, Willie Calvert and Jerry Aldridge, Jerry is a woman, by the way, Geraldine Aldridge, came to Regina in 1969 as part of a fundraising tour. At the time, Bobby Seale, one of the co-founders of the party, was on trial for conspiracy, the so-called conspiracy to disrupt the 1968 Democratic National Convention, which was, in fact, held in Chicago. Yeah. Seale was not one of the organizers of the protests outside the convention. He just happened to be there. And as, you know, kind of part of this new left world, he spoke at one of the meetings, but he kind of got lumped in with the other organizers. And there were different categories of people on trial. There were the politicos, the guys who were actually trying to disrupt the convention for political reasons. There were the yippies, the Youth International Party, that just wanted to have a party in the park and, you know, have fun and show that one can live peacefully. A festival of life they wanted to hold, in contrast to what they called the party of death. And what they meant was the Democrats who were responsible for leading the U.S. into involvement in the Vietnam War. Uh-huh. And so Bobby Seale wasn't really part of that organization, but he got lumped in with them when the state brought charges, conspiracy charges against them. And so in court, Bobby Seale was insisting upon his own lawyer in court. He didn't want to be defended by the lawyer who was defending the other defendants. But his lawyer, Charles Gary, was not available at the time. I think he was recovering from surgery or something on the West Coast, and he couldn't travel. And so, you know, Judge Julius Hoffman, who is very much a part of that establishment, the same as Mayor Daley, the same as J. Edgar Hoover, right, the man, who just didn't understand this new wave of radical activism, said, okay, well, you have a lawyer, you have representation, are you refusing this representation? And Bobby Seale kept on insisting that he had a right to representation and he had a right to choose his own representation. Okay. And Julius Hoffman was saying, you have a lawyer. You know, and so Bobby Seale kept on disrupting the proceedings, saying this is unconstitutional, you know, you can't do this, I have rights. And so Hoffman had him ordered bound and gagged in court, literally silencing the man. So the imagery of a black man in chains, right, with a gag in his mouth, not put there gently by the Chicago police, I might add, certainly caused a lot of problems, right? And also was a point of fundraising for the Black Panther Party. So Hampton and his colleagues came to Regina when they were invited by the Regina Students Union, in part to, you know, kind of raise funds and expose the injustices of this Bobby Seale trial that was going on at the time. But also because Hampton, like many other Panther leaders, was very committed to organizing the people. The Black Panthers had a membership that was exclusively black, but they weren't necessarily racially exclusive, right? They were interested in organizing anyone who was interested in revolution. And progressive peoples, as Fred Hampton put it, progressive peoples everywhere were under threat. And so I think that he was also very interested in making these kinds of connections across the border.
And one of the things that came up at the talk the other day, too, is that the Regina campus in Jim Petula has written about the Regina campus extensively, but the sense that the Regina campus is more activist than the University of Saskatchewan campus in Saskatoon. Mm-hmm. So that would help account maybe for why the Regina campus would send this invite to the Black Panthers.
I think so. The Regina campus had much more of a focus on liberal arts. It didn't have professional schools the way the University of Saskatchewan did at the time. The University of Regina today, of course, has some professional schools, but it still doesn't have the law school or the medical school. Those are located in Saskatoon. So the perception certainly was that, and I think it's probably true at the time, and like you said, Jim Pitsula is the, you know, kind of my main resource on this, was that Saskatoon had a more professional, more conservative student population, and the liberal arts students and the humanities students of the Regina campus kind of embraced their reputation of radicalism. And began taking on, you know, the university administration, much like the free speech movement was doing in the United States at the time. And also was very interested in civil rights issues and looked across the border as kind of a model for how to pattern their own activism. Because, of course, racial issues in Regina centered around, you know, the status of the Métis and problems of impoverished First Nations people.
So I'm assuming then that the reaction or the reception of Hampton was rather positive then on the campus, and that he would have been well received by the students. But I'm wondering, in the city outside of the campus, what was the reaction and you know, the things like the leader posts? I mean, how were people perceiving this action by the students and inviting Hampton to the city?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the things I discovered when I looked into this reaction, you're absolutely right. On campus, the student newspaper, the Carillon, reported that there were somewhere between 600 or 700 students attending the talk that he gave on campus, which is a, you know, a pretty good turnout for a relatively smallish campus. I don't know what the population of the Regina campus was at the time. It was a couple thousand at least, but not as big as it is today, obviously. So it was a good turnout. There was a positive write-up in the Carillon. There was a radical newspaper in town that, of course, did an interview that Hampton granted an interview to. He did not grant an interview to the Regina Leader Post, mm-hmm. More conservative newspaper. He indicated when he arrived, there was a big press contingent at the airport, and he indicated that he would not be speaking to the Regina Leader Post because he, quote, did not like what that paper printed about the Indians. Yeah. So, you know, he at least had some awareness, if even on a superficial level, yeah. of the conservatism of that newspaper and also the kind of general conservatism of Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan has a long history of racial discrimination. Certainly it was a site of Ku Klux Klan mm-hmm. activism in the 1920s and 30s, and even today Regina certainly has, you know, kind of inner city neighborhoods that are filled with gang problems, drug problems, mm-hmm. poverty problems amongst a majority First Nations yeah. population. So the campus reception, relatively positive. I mean, I didn't find a lot of negative response. I'm sure there were some students who were not happy sure. about well, Hampton coming. Not all students shared a particular radical bent. The response in the mainstream press, in the Leader Post, there were tons of letters written in and editorials, right, about this visit. And from what I gathered, a lot of people were upset, not necessarily because the Panthers were talking about, you know, the brutality of the American police or racial injustice in America. Canadians, you know, love to hang their hat on this idea that, well, of course, the U.S. is awful. We have no problems here. So yeah, if we can yeah. look to the United States and point out these social problems. So, but what they seemed to be upset about was the fact that the Panthers, Fred Hampton and the other two, routinely referred to authorities like the police as pigs. Right? These were pigs. And it was so disrespectful, right? The letters that I found that were critical of the visit were not critical of what the Panthers had to say about the community breakfast programs. They weren't critical about this idea of free medical clinics, right? Uh-huh. Canada, of course, having...
Especially in Saskatchewan.
I was going to say, Saskatchewan, home of Tommy Douglas, yeah. home of national health care. By 1969... you know, the rest of the nation had also adopted this idea of national health care. So they weren't critical of that. They were critical at how rude they seemed and how disrespectful to authority they seemed. And so I mean, at first I thought, oh, it's, you know, because Canadians are so polite. But no, I mean, I really think it is because a lot of these people writing into the Leader Post never encountered the same kinds of discrimination and police abuse right. that the Black Panthers encountered in the U.S. Now, there were other letter writers who pointed that out, saying, thank you for the Black Panthers to come in and come for their visit and pointing out these problems. I don't necessarily agree that the world is headed toward fascism. I'm not too sure about this, you know, revolution and overthrowing capitalism. Remember, it's still the Cold War. Yeah. But I might, another quote, I'll quote one of my sources from the Regina Leader Post. A man wrote in to say, you know, I don't think that the U.S. has already fallen to the forces of fascism, but if I were getting my head kicked in regularly by ghetto police, I might be inclined to think differently. Wow. So the response of the community was not entirely negative. You know, there was a lot of support. A letter writer, Lennox Keith, identified himself as a Black brother. He must have been an import. I don't know of a lot of Afro-Canadians living in Saskatchewan in the late 1960s. So certainly he was a racial minority. I didn't sense the racial status of any of the other letter writers. Right. But it wasn't all negative in the community, although there was a certain amount of criticism.
But then another area or another group that was relatively positive to the Black Panthers coming mm-hmm. and actually created a bit of a connection with the group mm-hmm. was the local First Nations and mm-hmm. Aboriginal groups. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just wondering if you could talk about, you know, how those connections were made and how those relationships mm-hmm. were built, because there are certainly parallels mm-hmm. between First Nations in Canada and African Americans in the United States.
Yeah, there certainly are. And sadly, I don't know as much as I, you know, hope to learn mm-hmm. one day about these relationships. I know that Hampton had made plans to talk with Harry Daniels, who was head of the local Indian Métis organization. I know that by the late 60s, in early 1970s. Certainly Harry Daniels had taken the fight to the federal level in terms of gaining status for the Métis, right? Mm-hmm. Status, Indian status, or Aboriginal status, I should say, for Métis peoples, which had been long denied. So he was identified very early on as a leader of this, you know, kind of racial minority group in the province that were adopting a much more radical stance than the provincial premier or the federal government ever expected mm-hmm. out of Aboriginals, mm-hmm. right? Because, you know, for so long, they didn't have much say politically, economically. You know, the idea of radicalism was new to Canada and new to the province, certainly by the late 1960s, and Harry Daniels kind of led that fight. And so I don't know what was said.
Right.
Sadly, right. Harry Daniels has passed away. I haven't been able to, you know, identify anyone who was at that meeting, and I don't have any records of what they talked about. I imagine it was an interesting conversation.
I can imagine so. Too. Yeah. But it's interesting that in that respect, you can almost see the Black Panthers. As I mean, you mentioned that, you know, all Black membership, but in this respect, here's a way that, you know, they can foster this relationship and develop, maybe coordinate even with the community in Regina, because they're facing similar types of issues, and it's a way to bridge out and expand their reach.
Right, and Hampton certainly acknowledged that, you know, they weren't there, they didn't come across the border to organize a Saskatchewan or a Regina chapter of the Black Panther Party, but they would be happy to help locals in organizing one if they wanted to, right? So it was like this strange moment to me when I read that, because I'm like, wow, that... These would not be, in fact, Black Panthers. They would be, I guess we could call them Red Panthers, right?
Whatever they choose to call themselves.
It was this acknowledgement that I think speaks to the fact that Fred Hampton, in particular, and he was not alone, but he certainly stressed this more than other leaders. Eldridge Cleaver, who was the National Minister of Information coming out of the Oakland chapter, by 1969, 1970, he had kind of split from the mainstream and was... the mainstream of the party split from Newton and emphasized Black nationalism, Black separatism. And so it led to a big divide within the party. Who are they going to support? Cleaver, who had the cred. You know, he spent time in Folsom Prison. He, you know, was a very eloquent spokesman. He was the Minister of Information, after all. He had written a very popular book with the New Left called Soul on Ice about, you know, kind of the abuses that the Black man faced in the U.S. And then Huey Newton. Right. Yeah. Who also had the street cred, who had spent time in prison, who had been convicted of murder. It was overturned on a technicality. Like, he had beaten the system. And so who were the Panthers? Who were the rank and file going to follow?
Right.
And Fred Hampton was emerging very, very early on as kind of a national leader, a leader who appeared to be able to kind of unite the masses, the colored masses, but also progressive masses. And that caused a great deal of fear amongst kind of white authorities in the U.S., which is why, you know, arguably he was targeted by the Chicago police.
Now, before he gets home, the circumstances through which, it wasn't him though, it was his two traveling compatriots, the circumstances through which they leave the country are rather interesting.
So what
was the story behind
that? Yeah. Well, before they even arrived, there were, I found evidence of letters to the federal, you know, immigration minister from, I forget what the official office is, the Saskatchewan Attorney General or equivalent, right? Saying to the immigration minister, you know, this is a seditious group. Right? We shouldn't let these people into our country because of the threat of violence, the threat of revolution, this idea that they were, you know, arguing to overthrow capitalist society, that they wanted to do this. The immigration minister said, well, our policy is, you know, in the absence of illegal activity, when they are invited by a reputable organization, which the Regina Students Union was, in spite of all their activism on campus, they apparently were still somewhat reputable, and they were invited. So our policy is that we're going to let them in. So there was a bit of a debate at the higher levels of government about whether or not to even let these speakers in. And Hampton and Calvert and Aldridge weren't the only Panthers that came to Canada. Many others did in different provinces, and they encountered differing levels of difficulty in getting there. So they come to the Regina campus. They're invited to both Saskatchewan and Alberta. They were going to give a talk in Alberta as well, at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. But they were stopped at the border between Saskatchewan and Alberta. And apparently what had happened was after the talk in Regina, after everybody got all riled up, I guess, they were stopped at the border, and Aldridge and Calvert were deported from the country, allegedly because they had entered the country with false identification. Hampton, this is really interesting because Hampton at the time was out on bail for that ice cream truck robbery in Maywood. So he was the only one who actually faced any legal troubles in the United States. He was not officially deported. He was invited to leave the country, and he did leave when his, you know, fellow Panthers were deported. So it's kind of a weird situation where the two who were not facing criminal charges in the U.S. were deported, whereas Hampton, who was facing these charges, was actually not deported. He just left with his friends.
And then so he goes back to Chicago. Yes. And what's sort of the situation that – because he doesn't live for much longer.
No, he doesn't. A few weeks more.
So what's the situation that he returns to, and what are the circumstances behind his murder?
In the late 1960s in Chicago, police violence had, of course, been ongoing against racial minorities, but it had ramped up. By 1968, that kind of violence was spilling over to other targets as well. The 1968 Democratic National Convention, yes. Right? The Walker Commission report that investigated this riot outside the convention hall concluded that, in fact, it was a police riot. It was the police going after the press, going after protesters, white kids, right. As
oh,
well.
They went after Dan Rather on the convention
They did.
Floor.
They I mean, did. Yeah. Exactly. The targeting of the press was particularly, I think, something that surprised a lot of people. And a lot of white Chicago residents weren't familiar with this kind of police violence. Black folk stayed away from the convention. They're like, we don't want any part of this because we know what's going to happen because it had been happening to them for, you know, years and years. Mm-hmm. So by the late 1960s, police violence in Chicago had ramped up. Gang violence had ramped up as well. Let's, you know, to be honest, there's a lot of black gang activity in the black neighborhoods, in the Hispanic neighborhoods. At the time, I'm not aware of a lot of gang activities in Chinatown and on the north side, Korean and Vietnamese neighborhoods, but certainly there would have been that kind of influence as well. So there's a lot of fighting in the streets. And you've got this really charismatic leader that the black community in Chicago is responding to. They're saying, you know, I don't know about this socialism stuff that he's talking about, but I know that they're feeding my kids. And if the authorities try and take away that breakfast program, I'm going to kick some ass, right? Like, you've got mothers saying this. And so Edward Hanrahan was elected in 1968 as the Cook County State's Attorney. That's the lead prosecutor for Chicago. And Hanrahan was very much a cog in the Daley machine. Mayor Daley had kind of handpicked him as his successor. Mayor Daley had, by this point, been in office since 1955. He was getting on in years. You know, he ended up dying as mayor in 1976. He served 21 years as mayor and an additional 5 years as head of the Cook County Democratic Party, which, you know, was kind of the only party in town. There were Republicans that ran, but barely. So Hanrahan was this, you know, kind of establishment prosecutor, and he wanted to go after the gangs, right? And so he's going to establish this war on gangs, the special prosecution unit to target the gangs. And to him, the Black Panthers were just another gang. And he talked, in fact, when he announced the special initiative, this gang initiatives and the special prosecutions unit, he announced it to a group of, you know, black mothers in the ghetto, and they booed him off stage. They're like, they're not animals. Right. These are our children. And they're fighting these racist police officers, these abusive police officers. So Hampton is a very charismatic leader. He's getting a lot of positive press in, you know, the Black Panther newspaper, but also in the, you know, regular newspapers of Chicago. The mainstream press was, it depended on the paper, right? The Chicago Tribune was a little more conservative, a little more intransigent, didn't really like. They were a daily paper. Whereas the Sun-Times was a little more sympathetic to the civil rights movement, to radical activism. So Fred Hampton was this figure who could have replaced Martin Luther King Jr., right, as this kind of central figure of the movement. Arguably, he could have replaced him. King, of course, was assassinated in April of 1968, leaving the movement without a national figurehead. So a lot of
Malcolm X.
Malcolm X had been assassinated in 1965,
yeah,
right?
So, I mean, so two of your main,
yeah,
you know, within the past 4 years are mm-hmm. gone. And at the same time, then you got Bobby Kennedy also gets killed then in 1969.
Exactly.
Or 68, excuse me. Mm-hmm. Campaigning. And, mm-hmm. and it's this whole, like,
yeah, one after yeah. another, right? These main leaders, right? Yeah. These inspiring, charismatic leaders. Yeah, and so that is one thing they all certainly share yeah, in common, yeah. the charisma of the Malcolm X.
And it creates this void.
Yeah, it did.
At the head of the movement.
It really did. And by this point in the late 60s, early 70s, you know, the Panther Party is also kind of splitting. You know, different chapters are doing their own thing. And Newton, Huey Newton himself, had a somewhat paranoid personality. He was prone to drug abuse. He was also prone to kind of the celebrity status he had. He kind of fell victim to thinking he was this demagogue, right? Yeah. And the party he created, he lost control of, as the different geographic chapters were doing their own thing and creating things like medical clinics, free medical clinics, or liberation schools. And so you see a lot of divides within the party itself, which of course is helped out by COINTELPRO infiltration and interruptance. The government is trying to break this party up. Fred Hampton was the kind of charismatic leader that people responded to, and I think there was a great deal of fear that he was going to step into that void, that leadership void. So it all kind of came together, right? Hanrahan gets elected. He creates this war on gangs, the special prosecution unit. COINTELPRO gathers the intel to be able to target the Chicago chapter of the Black Panther Party, you know, serve warrants for illegal weapons possession, because they did have guns, right? Yep. And many of them were illegally obtained. And so on December 4th, 1969, the Chicago police, who staffed the special prosecutors unit, executed a raid on the headquarters of the Black Panther Party, which was the apartment that Fred Hampton and his girlfriend at the time, who was pregnant, 8 months pregnant at the time, lived in. And there were several other Panthers that were there, as was typical in Panther headquarters and crash pads. One of them was Mark Clark. He was a wannabe Panther, I'll call him, from downstate Peoria, Illinois. He was organizing his own chapter in another city downstate, and he was there to, you know, kind of find out from how to do it, right, and to get some insights. And so the police executed this raid, a warrant, and raided the apartment. From the start, the raid was very strange. They didn't use tear gas, which would have been typical to clear out the apartment. Uh-huh. Instead, they allegedly, the police said they identified themselves as police officers and that the Panthers came out shooting. And then Fred Hampton ends up getting killed, and Mark Clark as well were killed in this raid. And there's pictures showing the police carrying the body of Hampton out of this apartment, and one of the police officers is just smiling. Like, we got him, you know? And then it got even weirder. The police did not secure the crime scene, and so the Panthers did.
Oh, okay.
They didn't let the police back in. And they started giving tours through the apartment to show all of the inconsistencies that the official report, the police report, which said, you know, we called out that we were the police, we were executing this warrant, and shots were fired at us, so we shot back. Well, that wasn't what happened, because when ballistics went in, they called the Panthers called their own ballistic experts in. The bullets recovered at the crime scene, there were something like 99, 98 bullets recovered at the crime scene. One of them came from Panthers guns. The rest came from the police guns.
Wow.
Fred Hampton was shot in such a manner that, you know, he was laying down in bed when the warrant was executed, and there's no evidence to suggest that someone purposefully drugged him, but he did have drugs in his system. He was not a drug user. So it's possible that the COINTELPRO informant might have drugged him, but we don't know, because that informant then later on killed himself much later on. So I don't know if there's a direct connection. So, you know, Hampton didn't get up, and he was shot in such a way that the police, you know, kind of in execution style, the police shot him. So it was pretty clear from the start that the raid did not go down as Hanrahan and the police said it went down. None of these men were ever indicted on criminal charges. even though independent investigations, you know, kind of brought up all these inconsistencies, these were still, you know, participants in the machine, and Chicago juries never held them criminally accountable for these actions. However, Panther lawyers went after the city and went after the feds and pursued civil charges for the violation of Panther's civil rights, eventually winning a several million dollar settlement, although it took a long time. So it's pretty clear that this was not, you know, a botched raid. It was pretty clear it was an execution, right, that they meant to go after
him. So it was successful from the police's point of view.
In that they murdered Fred Hampton, yeah. Yes.
What was the reaction to this then, if you've looked at it, in mm-hmm. Regina, because mm-hmm. he was just there? Was there a strong reaction either on campus mm-hmm. or in the community?
There was. There was a torchlight parade, you know, a kind of candlelight vigil held mm-hmm. in memory of Fred Hampton. There were lots of newspaper reports condemning the brutality of the American police. You know, the Regina Leader Post headline was, you know, Chicago Panther leader dies in Chicago gunfight. And the report was all about how, you know, it was the police story, right?
Right.
The police executed this raid for illegal weapons possession and in the process ended up in a shootout in which Fred Hampton, who had recently visited our province, was killed by the police. It didn't report all the inconsistencies in the evidence. It certainly didn't report the conditions of police violence against blacks in Chicago, mm-hmm. African Americans in Chicago. So the reaction then after this by the Regina community, or certainly some of the Regina community, was sympathy with the Panthers, with the Panther agenda, with the suggestion that, you know, as we ramp up radical activism in Canada, as we start to fight against the social injustice of racial discrimination, of, you know, economic inequalities, the same things are going to happen to us if we don't do something about it, that the RCMP is going to start operating like the Chicago police will mm-hmm. if we're successful in our fight against injustice. So there was a lot of sympathy in the community after Fred Hampton was killed. And I think part of that is certainly the personal connection. He was just there.
Yeah.
He was in the province, I think, November 18th. He was murdered December 4th.
Right.
So,
yeah, so
3 weeks later.
Yeah. Do you think maybe that the fact then that he's killed so soon after that leads to this legacy? Like you say, I mean, your students told you about this visit.
Mm-hmm.
And so clearly it's something that they know about mm-hmm. and something that is talked about in Saskatchewan mm-hmm. or at least in Regina still. So
mm-hmm.
so the fact that the murder was so soon after mm-hmm. or even that he was murdered at all,
mm-hmm.
Does that maybe lend itself to this legacy mm-hmm. of this visit and holding it up as this really very interesting moment mm-hmm. in Regina's history?
Yeah. I mean, I think in part, sure. I mean, there's a certain martyrdom to Fred Hampton. He was such a dynamic leader and was able to lead so briefly, right?
Yeah.
Like I said, the party was organized, the chapter in Chicago was organized in 68. He was killed at the end of 69. So he had like 2 years of activism as a Black Panther, as a known Black Panther, even though his activism went back further than that. But other Panthers were killed too, right? So I think the personal connection, the fact that it was Fred Hampton who had visited, right? That I think is a bigger part of that issue. His legacy certainly is profound, but there were lots of Panthers who were killed. There were lots of other civil rights leaders who were killed that students don't necessarily know the names of. So I don't know. I do think that there is that personal connection, though.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. Now, shifting gears just a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about something else that's not too pleasant.
Okay.
your book came out last year, mm-hmm. which was your dissertation.
Yes.
Right?
Originally.
Yes. So it's called Rape in Chicago, Race, Myth, and the Court. So again, studying Chicago.
Yes.
And so just a little snippet, what's the book about? Mm-hmm. Let's sell a couple copies.
Oh, excellent. Well, the book, like you said, came from my doctoral thesis, which was called Proving Rape. And I looked at issues of race relations, certainly in the city of Chicago, but also gender relations, and how individuals who find themselves in the court system use that system to hold up, you know, their rights as American citizens, right? And how they're defended in court against rape charges. Most of the defendants that I looked at were African Americans. Mm-hmm. They weren't all there accused of raping white women, which is kind of the traditional trope of sexual violence, that it's interracial, that it's these black men who can't control themselves. They're going to sexually attack these innocent white women. What I found in the book was that, in fact, a lot of victims didn't fit that kind of innocent, middle-class, chaste image of the rape victim, the typical rape victim. A lot of the defendants were black because of the data set I looked at. These were appellate cases, so they originally ended with conviction. So were white men not being charged with rape, or were they just not being convicted of it, or did they plea bargain down? Mm. By the period I'm looking at, the 1930s through the 1970s, probably 80% of criminal cases went to plea bargain. They never went to court. So I had a limited data set, which shaped, you know, certainly the number of defendants that were racial minority defendants. But what I was interested in learning more about was how the individuals in the court system who find themselves unwillingly caught up in this system as either defendants or victims, how they use the system to kind of assert their rights as American citizens. So
it's Rape in Chicago, Race, Myth, and the Courts, University of Illinois Press, 2012.
Yes.
And we can say with absolute certainty that it does not cost $47,000.
It does not cost $47,000 and some change. If you go to Amazon.ca, it is a misprint, the price. However, you can get it from chapters.ca or Amazon.com if you're in the U.S. or.
And of course, I'm sure if you offered to pay $47,000 for it, I don't think you wouldn't turn it down.
I wouldn't turn it down, but I don't think I would get it because I have to sell a certain amount of copies before I get any kind of commission. But anyway.
So that's Don Flood from Campion College at the University of Regina. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Sean.
And if you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com, Twitter at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Check out activehistory.ca for more features and articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.